Hi, this is Dwight Gingrich, and you are listening to Was Jesus Okay with Homosexuality? Session 3 of 6. This session is called Does Love Your Neighbor Mean Jesus Affirmed Gay Love? I originally shared this material as a blog post. The blog version of this session includes extra features, including 16 footnotes documenting my sources and adding extra comments. To access these features, visit www.dwightgingrich.com and search for the 6-part series, Was Jesus Okay with Homosexuality? Let's begin Session 3. If there is one thing that all Americans may agree on about Jesus, it is that he taught us to love. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, and love your neighbor as yourself, are two of our favorite Jesus quotes. Judge not, and he that is without sin among you, let him first cast a stone, are often thrown in or at for good measure. But how do love and homosexuality fit together for Jesus and his followers? Here there is far less agreement. In my last post, I argued, based on evidence from Jewish history, that it is virtually certain that Rabbi Jesus agreed homosexual behavior is wrong. This is true even if he never explicitly mentioned homosexuality. Overwhelming historical evidence demands that this must be our working hypothesis in any discussion of Jesus and homosexuality, virtually certain unless there is very strong evidence to the contrary. And then we need to explain how such evidence was somehow missed by all his first listeners. Is Jesus' teaching on love such evidence? Is Jesus' emphasis on love proof that he approved of loving homosexual relationships? Does love your neighbor mean Jesus affirmed gay love? Love and homosexuality. What did ancient Jews and Christians say? Jesus' life was marked by unusual compassion and love. He not only taught love of friend and enemy alike, he also modeled it by welcoming and honoring social nobodies of all sorts. Jesus welcomed children. Let the children come to me and do not hinder them. Luke 18:16. Jesus had compassion on the crowds. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. Matthew 9:36. Jesus attracted women. There were also many women there who had followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him. Matthew 27:55. Jesus said nice things about prostitutes. Truly I say to you, the prostitutes go into the kingdom of God before you. Matthew 21:31. Jesus protected a woman caught in adultery. Let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her. John 8:7. And Jesus was accused of being a friend of the wrong crowd. Look at him, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Matthew 11:19. Matthew Vines emphasizes Jesus' example of love at the climax of his viral video, The Gay Debate, The Bible and Homosexuality. Quote, Jesus placed a particular focus on those others overlooked, on those who were outcast, on mistreated and marginalized minorities. And if we are working to emulate the life of Christ, then that's where our focus needs to be too. How fully have you absorbed not just the existence of gay and lesbian Christians, but the depth of the pain and the hurt that their own brothers and sisters have inflicted on them? Does that pain grieve you as though it were your own? Vine's words here about love are true and on point. This is a message that all Christians, myself included, need to consider and act on. As Preston Sprinkle reminds us, when we discuss homosexuality, we are discussing people to be loved, not just an issue. However, Vines makes these statements about Jesus' love in the context of arguing that, quote, The Bible never directly addresses, and it certainly does not condemn, loving, committed same-sex relationships. Vines claims that those who use the Bible to speak against homosexual behavior are denying gay people love. Quote, "You are uniquely unworthy of loving and being loved by another person, and all because you're different, because you're gay." Unquote. Here, it seems to me, Vines is badly misunderstanding both the nature of love and the significance of Jesus' example of love. Jesus' life of love was truly remarkable, yet it is virtually meaningless as evidence that Jesus approved of homosexual relationships. Here are three reasons, rooted in history, why I can make such a confident claim. First, ancient Jews saw no contradiction between commanding neighbor love and condemning homosexual activity. In the Law of Moses, the famous command to love one's neighbor and the commands against homosexual behavior are found practically shoulder to shoulder. Leviticus 18:22, "You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination." Leviticus 19, verse 18, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." Leviticus 19:34, "You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself." Leviticus 20:13, "If a man lies with a male as with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood is upon them." It is questionable at best to say that because Jesus quoted and affirmed "love your neighbor" from Leviticus, he therefore disagreed with "you shall not lie with a male as with a woman" from the same text. Instead, these passages demonstrate that ancient Jews did not think that affirming homosexual relationships was a logical or necessary outworking of an ethic of love. Rabbi Emanuel Jakobitz confirms this conclusion in his entry on homosexuality in the Encyclopedia Judaica. He contrasts modern liberal Christian attitudes about love with the perspective found in Jewish law. Quote, "Whereas the more liberal attitude found in some modern Christian circles is possibly due to the exaggerated importance Christians have traditionally accorded to the term love," quote, "Whereas the more liberal attitude found in some modern Christian circles is possibly due to the exaggerated importance Christians have traditionally accorded to the term love, Jewish law holds that no hedonistic ethic, even if called love, can justify the morality of homosexuality any more than it can legitimize adultery, incest, or polygamy, however genuinely such acts may be performed out of love and by mutual consent." Unquote. Why then is Jesus' emphasis on love not proof that he approved of loving homosexual relationships? One reason is that ancient Jews saw no contradiction between commanding neighbor love and condemning homosexual activity. Second, early Christians such as the Apostle Paul likewise did not see any contradiction between urging neighbor love and warning against homosexual practice. Paul's first letter to the church at Corinth contains an entire chapter exalting love, the famous love chapter, 1 Corinthians 13. But the same letter also includes this: "Do not be deceived, neither the sexually immoral nor men who practice homosexuality will inherit the kingdom of God," 1 Corinthians 6, verses 9 to 10. Similarly, Paul's letter to the Roman church, which contains the New Testament's longest passage critiquing homosexual activity, Romans 1, 24 to 27, also emphasizes that all the commandments are summed up in this word, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself," Romans 13, verse 9. Here we must detour briefly to address a question about which whole chapters have been written. Was Paul really speaking against homosexual behaviors of all kinds in these passages? That is indeed how the church read Paul for nearly 2,000 years, but a seemingly unending variety of revisionist readings have been appearing in recent decades. Are we wrong to understand Paul as speaking generally against homosexual behavior in these passages, or in other places like 1 Timothy 1, 9-10? Our first response to this question must be to remember that Paul was a Jew. He was trained as a Pharisee, and he stood in a longer religious tradition where, quote, for a period of about 2,000 years, all Jews everywhere taught that homosexual unions of any sort were sinful and against nature, unquote. That from Fortson and Grams. That historical context was our starting point in interpreting Jesus' silence in our last session, and it must also be our starting point in interpreting Paul's teachings. That Paul was standing in this Jewish tradition is reinforced by the fact that he apparently drew directly on the law of Moses to coin an original term for a male homosexual. Paul apparently created the word arsenokoute, or literally male betters, as found in 1 Corinthians 6:9 and 1 Timothy 1:10. He apparently created that word from two words found in the Greek translation of Leviticus 20, verse 13. The words there being arsenos, meaning male, and koute, meaning bed. Put together, arsenos and koute make arsenokoute, male better. This word, like its source text in Leviticus, appears to be a very general reference to males who practice same-sex relations. In this Jewish context, it is nearly meaningless to argue that Paul's statements could be understood to leave a loophole for some positive forms of homosexual behavior. In this historical context of Jews prohibiting all same-sex sexual relations and preserving the male-female created order, it is somewhat beside the point to suggest that Paul doesn't have long-term loving same-sex relationships in view. In this historical context, debates about the precise meanings of the terms Paul used to condemn homosexual behaviors become secondary. To counter centuries of consistent Jewish teaching against all forms of homosexual behavior, we would need to see clear positive endorsement of some sort of homosexual behavior by Paul, not merely a failure to explicitly condemn all forms. But we don't see that. Instead, if we read Paul's statements about homosexuality within the context of previous Jewish writings on the topic, we see that his statements are right at home. Just like them, he builds his case on both Jewish law, like his word arsenokoute, and on nature and creation, as we see in Romans 1:24-27. And just like other Jews, he speaks against the homosexual union itself, arsenokoute, male betters, and against unions that involved mutual desire, his statement about passion for one another in Romans 1:27. Paul even speaks against female-female unions in Romans 1:26. In short, there is nothing in Paul's teaching on the ethics of homosexuality to indicate that he was carving a path contrary to his Jewish predecessors. Kyle Harper, in a recent book published by Harvard University Press, warns against any hermeneutic roundabout that tries to sanitize or soften Paul's words about same-sex relationships. Quote, for Paul, same-sex attraction symbolized the estrangement of men and women at the very level of their inmost desires from nature and from the creator of nature. For the historian, any hermeneutic roundabout that tries to sanitize or soften Paul's words is liable to obscure the inflection point around which attitudes toward same-sex erotics would be forever altered within Roman culture. Paul's overriding sense of gender, rather than age or status, as the primary determinant in the propriety of a sexual act, was nurtured by contemporary Jewish attitudes. By reducing the sex act down to the most basic constituents of male and female, Paul was able to re-describe the sexual culture surrounding him in transformative terms. Unquote. Despite Harper's warning, there are many current revisionist readings of Paul to consider, and also many interpretive questions to answer. For those who wish to dig deeper into Paul, on my blog I have a link to a transcript of an interview with Robert Gagnon, or I would recommend that you see the book Unchanging Witness, The Consistent Christian Teaching on Homosexuality in Scripture and Tradition by Fortson and Grams. See especially chapters 16 to 18 on Paul. With apologies, then, both for getting sidetracked with Paul and for giving him such cursory treatment, we return to Jesus. Here again is our takeaway point from Paul. Paul did not see any contradiction between urging neighbor love and warning against homosexual practice. Both the Jewish scriptures, before Jesus, and Paul, after Jesus, condemned homosexual behavior while also teaching the command, love your neighbor as yourself. On these ethical matters of love and homosexuality, Paul and Moses were in complete agreement. Jesus was also a Jew. He taught neighbor love using the very same commandment from the law of Moses that Paul used. This is no reason to conclude he disagreed with Moses and Paul on the ethics of homosexual behavior. Why then is Jesus' emphasis on love not proof that he approved of loving homosexual relationships? First, ancient Jews saw no contradiction between commanding neighbor love and condemning homosexual activity. Second, early Christians such as the Apostle Paul likewise did not see any contradiction between urging neighbor love and warning against homosexual practice. And third, rather than equating love with sexual freedom, the New Testament commonly contrasts love and sexual indulgence. Don't miss how radically different this is from our culture. In fact, this is one of those times when the culture of the New Testament, or even just of ancient Jews, is so radically different from our own culture that it is mind-bending. Modern Western culture, at least since the 1960s, typically equates love with sexual freedom. The language of love has been adopted by those promoting LGBTQ+ lifestyle choices, so that banners proclaiming messages such as "Love Wins" or "Love is Love" are commonplace in gay pride marches and on social media. This use of love language is so ubiquitous that it is almost automatic for a person to feel they are being unloving if they speak against homosexual behavior. To step from this mindset into the ethics of the New Testament is akin to jumping into a cold lake on a very hot day. The shock is great enough that most people complain that the water is too cold, rather than considering that the problem may be found in their own overheated bodies. Rather than equating love with sexual freedom, as our culture does, the New Testament specifically contrasts love and sexual immorality. It is not just that the New Testament sees some sexual freedom as loving and some as not. Rather, it sees sexual freedom and love as polar opposites. You are asked to choose one or the other. Paul's letter to the Ephesians may contain the clearest example, from Ephesians 5, verses 2 to 3. Walk in love, as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. But sexual immorality and all impurity or covetousness must not even be named among you. Paul's letter to the Colossians tells us to put to death what we might call sexual freedom and to put on love instead. Colossians chapter 3, verses 5, 12, and 14. Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you, sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire. Put on, then, as God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, compassionate hearts, kindness, and above all these put on love. Paul's letter to the Galatians also agrees, essentially saying, do not practice sexual immorality, impurity, or sensuality, but instead love each other. Here's from Galatians 5, excerpts from verses 13 to 22. Do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now the works of the flesh are evident, sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality. But the fruit of the Spirit is love. Peter agrees with Paul, see 1 Peter 4, verses 3 to 8, and so does the writer of Hebrews. Near the end of his letter, he writes, let brotherly love continue. Then he gives several examples of how to practice brotherly love, including this. Let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled, for God will judge the sexually immoral and adulterous. Hebrews 13, verse 4. Again, it is easy to miss how radical this New Testament ethic is. Remember that these writers are all Jews who agreed that homosexual activity of any sort is sinful. When they mention sexual immorality, they think that term includes homosexual practices. We should not imagine that they think some homosexual activity is immoral and some is loving. Rather, as Jewish Christians, they all believe that all homosexual behavior is contrary to God's will, and therefore, contrary to true love. Love and the most important commandment. How can we explain this radical New Testament idea that sexual freedom and true love are at odds with each other? One source of this thinking is the Jewish heritage of the New Testament writers. For example, the Jewish philosopher Philo, a contemporary of Jesus, complained about how some people abused the term love in his day. Quote, seduction is an offense which is similar and nearly related to adultery, as they are both sprung from one common mother, incontinence. But some of those persons who are accustomed to dignify shameful actions by specious names call this love, blushing to confess the real truth concerning its character. Remember also the statement of Rabbi Jacobitz, as quoted above. Jewish law holds that no hedonistic ethic, even if called love, can justify the morality of homosexuality. Unquote. Another foundation for this New Testament perspective is Jesus' teaching on the two great commandments. In Jesus' view, which is also the historic Jewish view, love for neighbor is properly understood as the second commandment, not the first. It must always be defined in relation to the most important commandment, you shall love the Lord your God. In Mark 12, verses 28 to 31, we read, one of the scribes asked him, which commandment is the most important of all? Jesus answered, the most important is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these. Ben Witherington's helpful definition of neighbor love takes this priority into account. Quote, love in the New Testament is not mainly or merely a warm, mushy feeling or sentiment, but a decision of the will to do what God commands in regard to the neighbor. Unquote. It is not ultimately loving, then, to help your neighbor violate God's will. In Jesus and Paul's eyes, love for someone new was never a valid argument in favor of adultery or divorce, not even if both marriage partners wanted the adultery or divorce to happen. To the contrary, Paul said that the commandment, you shall not commit adultery, is summed up in this word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, Romans 13:9. In Paul's view, to not commit adultery is to love your neighbor. Since neighbor love was a decision of the will to do what God commands in regard to the neighbor, this meant that even mutually desired divorce was prohibited because it violated God's creation pattern of male-female marriage for life. The same realities apply to what Vines calls loving, committed, same-sex relationships. In the ethics of ancient Jews and Christians, neither divorce, except on the ground of sexual immorality, nor homosexual activity were considered legitimate expressions of human love, for they both violated what Jesus called the most important commandment, love of God. It is important to keep the most important love commandment in mind when listening to perspectives like the following from a lecture by Ted Grimsrud, Senior Professor of Peace Theology at Eastern Mennonite University. Quote, "In terms of their mission, Christian churches should take as their starting point a general stance of welcome or invitation or hospitality toward all people. Jesus' welcome to sinners included welcoming both people who had violated Torah, for example, the woman caught in adultery, Zacchaeus the tax collector, and the woman of the city who washed his feet, and people who were inappropriately labeled unclean, such as poor people, lepers, or menstruating women. The Bible does place a high priority on the need for the faith community to sustain a clear identity as God's people, so we should resist forces within the community that compromise that identity. Not everything goes, but we limit hospitality only in order to serve the vocation of welcome. In relation to same-sex intimacy, same-sex marriage, and homosexuality in general, the fundamental call to hospitality does not fully resolve the issues. However, we should see the call to hospitality as the starting point." Unquote. This perspective takes something truly beautiful, hospitality or love of neighbor, and promotes it out of its place as the second commandment to become the starting point. Given this beginning, it is little wonder that Grimsrud goes on to seek a hermeneutic roundabout for each biblical prohibition of same-sex relations. Making Jesus' most important commandment the starting point for our discussion of love and homosexuality leads to different conclusions. What is love, and who gets to define it? What then is love, and what does it truly look like? Who gets to decide if a given action is actually loving? Is it possible to love a person while hating what they do? It appears to me that it is impossible to agree on what true love is until we also agree in significant measure about what truth is. What, for example, does it mean to love someone who experiences homosexual desires? Does it mean supporting a person in their goals of achieving whatever pleasures, rights, or freedoms they desire? Does it mean withholding support even when it is asked for if you disagree with their goals? Does it mean warning them of the dangers of their goals based on truth as best you can see it? Or does it mean withholding warning, even if that may mean their ultimate destruction? Until we agree on truth, it is pretty much impossible to agree on which of the above or any other alternative is actually loving. Love without truth is like cake batter without a mold. Fortson and Grams explain, quote, "What happens with the criterion of love in a culture that highly values freedom is that love is defined in terms of freedom. The loving thing to do becomes letting people do what they want to do, as long as the rights of others are not infringed. Like cake batter, love takes the shape of the mold into which it is poured. In the West, this mold consists of liberation and equality. No society will stand with so meager a basis for thinking through its great moral challenges. Citizens of Western culture lack a robust enough moral vocabulary and ethic to explain why they object to things their consciences feel are wrong. In the public square, they are restricted to the language of freedom and equality in all moral matters." Unquote. What cake mold did Jesus use to define true love? Clearly, the mold any ancient Jew used was the commands of God, including his commands about sexual immorality. Nothing could be truly loving unless it was in line with God's law. As Jesus said, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments." John 14, verse 15. Conclusion. Jesus' teachings on love, then, do not in any way suggest that he was okay with homosexual relationships. If we conclude this, then we, like vines above, are importing our own cake mold into the first century. We are assuming that Jesus defined love according to our values and our concepts of truth, not by those of ancient Jews or the law of God. As we have seen, ancient Jews and early Christians alike both taught that one can love one's neighbor and disapprove of homosexual activity at the same time. In fact, the authors of the New Testament believed that sexual immorality in all forms was diametrically opposed to true love. Jesus' emphasis on love is not proof that he approved of loving homosexual relationships. If anything, in light of biblical ethics, it shows the opposite. Thank you for listening to Session 3 of Was Jesus Okay with Homosexuality? Session 4 digs deeper into historical evidence about Jesus' teaching, explaining why it's wrong to say Jesus said nothing about homosexuality. I invite you to continue listening or to visit www.dwightgingrich.com to leave a comment or review what you just heard. This material is copyright 2019 by Dwight Gingrich, but you have my permission to share it if you do so freely and give proper credit. Thanks again for listening, and God bless your day.